This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, May 4th, the Under His Eye edition. I'm Hanna Rosin, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. And in the New York studios today, we have June Thomas, a managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hanna. It's nice to hear you after seeing you on HBO a little while ago.
Ugh, the Bill Maher show. That was fun. That was fun.
It's a reminder of how television is king, because you're our queen of all media, but it's your TV appearances that people text me and like, Hannah's on the TV.
Well, it's more like your mom's friends. That's the category of people who like make you feel warm and fuzzy. It's like your mom's friend who you haven't heard from in 15 years who sees you on TV. So you're like, yeah, I'm on TV. Hi, Noreen. We forgot about you. Noreen
okay.
of New York Magazine. Hi.
Hi, Hannah.
So before we get going, I just want to say one thing. I tweeted a request for sports biographies, and I would say the winner is Andre Agassi's biography. Okay. So I'm definitely going to read it. Everyone said it's amazing. Madeline Cummings, thank you on Twitter, but many, many people recommended that to me. So that's going to be my reading for next week after I finishing The Handmaid's Tale, which we're going to talk about today. Okay, so our topics. The first is The Handmaid's Tale, the book by Margaret Atwood, which is now a miniseries on Hulu. We discuss its cultural relevance. Second is Brand Ivanka. I feel like we could talk about that any week, really, but it's just she's made great leaps forward this week. Now, that might happen every week, but, you know, she's got a book coming out, prominent roles on the international stage, big profile in the New York Times. So we are going to talk about her this week. And finally, a couple of prominent Democratic men, Bernie Sanders and Tom Perez, said some things implying that reproductive rights were not necessarily integral to progressive politics. And lots of people got upset. We are going to talk about that. And June, do you want to tell us about our Slate Plus topic?
Yes. In Slate Plus this week, we'll be asking, is the reaction and the coverage of the relationship between possible next French president Emmanuel Macron and his wife, Brigitte Trogneux, is the coverage of it sexist? And if you want to hear those Slate Plus segments, you can go to slate.com/XXPlus.
And also, we have an exciting announcement. We are having a live show. We haven't had one in a while, and so we are so excited to finally be doing one. It's on Thursday, June 22nd at the Bell House in Brooklyn. You can buy your tickets at slate.com/live. That's Thursday, June 22nd. Go to slate.com/live and buy your tickets for the live XX Gabfest. Yay!
We will have a very special guest to be announced very soon.
All right, our first topic, The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale. It's been turned into a TV series, now streaming on Hulu and starring Elizabeth Moss. In this dystopian religious republic, women are kept as a kind of sacred, fetishized cattle to breed for the increasingly barren wives of upper-class men. So it seems culturally relevant. It seems very culturally relevant. And in the New Yorker profile of Margaret Atwood, she has spoken of it as such. But I have to say, reading around, I feel like I misunderstood exactly what Margaret Atwood's politics were until I started thinking about it for this topic. So let's discuss. First of all, you guys have watched. We're only going to talk through episode 3 because that's what has aired on Hulu. Maybe episode 4 is already streamed, right?
It'll come out on Wednesday as we're taping this.
Okay. We will, I think, somewhat liberally talk about the first 3 episodes because they've already streamed, but we'll try not to give away absolute key plot points. And we certainly will not talk beyond that. So, Noreen, you said you had a strong reaction to watching. Can you talk about that?
I did. Well, so when I emailed you guys, it was like probably about midnight and I had just finished my first episode. And I'm not sort of a horror genre person or psychological horror genre. But this really kind of burrowed into my brain in a way that I wasn't expecting. And a choice that was made by the, you know, directors of this and also by Atwood when she was writing was to have it be very much in the present day. It looks visually like some cross between the Amish and a medieval time. But it's in fact, you know, in all the flashbacks, they're talking about Uber and they're like drinking bottles of wine the way you might with your friends. And that is what's really chilling about it, is the toggle between this repressive, backward seeming cult and the just the presence of modern day items.
I think that is why it has a cultural relevance, a sense that, you know, these things are closer than you think. Mm-hmm. And I actually think the miniseries does a brilliant job of updating and making the character seem so kind of familiar and relevant. The Elizabeth Moss character, who is named, actually. She's speculatively named in the novel, and she's definitively named. I'm not going to say what her name is.
Oh,
but,
can't we, though? It's so good.
I guess.
It's so good.
It was my favorite moment in any show in the last 10 years, at least, was the final,
oh, really?
The final lines of episode one, yes. The reason that we know what her name is that there's this amazing voiceover, which voiceovers often are a really heavy, it's a crutch that sort of average writers use, but that is not, and there are some fine examples of exceptions, you know, Mr. Robot, Jane the Virgin, but this voiceover that Elizabeth Moss's character does is fantastic, and it's really kind of how you learn, other than the flashbacks, that resistance is still taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the first episode, she reveals her real name. The name has been taken away from her because only the wives of the upper-class men have names now.
It all has to look the same. Because I intend to survive. For her. Her name is Hannah. My husband was Luke. My name is June.
Best name ever.
I was thinking, for the purposes of this podcast, you can be June. I guess I'm Off David. Wouldn't that be my name?
I don't know.
Off, I mean, David? Because I live in the household of David.
Yeah, but I think you might be his wife. You might be his Serena Joy. You know, I mean,
that's true.
You actually, you know, if you say you're an Off David, you're kind of saying that you're their sex slave.
I'm the sex slave. That's true. Yeah. The voiceover is really effective because of the thing that you said, Noreen, which is that she speaks in her modern, she speaks in the sort of recognizable modern idiom when she's speaking to herself in her own mind. But then the way she speaks publicly in the house is sort of extremely controlled and Puritan, as is required of a handmaid. So that's a real, like when they have these ritualized ceremonial sex once a month, because the problem in this society is a lack of fertility. That's well known about The Handmaid's Tale, so I feel like I can say that. That's what the job of the handmaids is. And in her head, as he's doing this very creepy ritualized intercourse, she's saying to herself, "I wish he'd hurry the fuck up," you know. And so the gap between what she looks like, the office she's performing, what she's wearing, and who she actually is in her mind is really effective, I think, in the miniseries.
And the contrast too between, you know, what's in her head and then the very ritualized kinds of exchanges that people are allowed to have, like, you know, there's all these phrases which I actually find quite desirable to introduce into my own vocabulary, despite all the freight that they carry, like under his eye is your is your kind of aloha, hello and goodbye greeting.
I think that's good for office rebellion.
Yeah.
Like if you have a boss you really don't like and you're doing things you're not supposed to be doing, you just say like under his eye. It's like it should be a quick U-E or something. And then you know you got to stop because the boss is coming.
Well, one thing that I did find like a little bit anachronistic just in terms of our concerns as a society. I bet if Margaret Atwood were writing this today, she might not make it a theocracy. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that if you were looking at sort of the radical right wing in, you know, 1984, 1985, you might be more concerned about a theocracy than you would be today when that part of the Republican Party is not ascendant. Donald Trump does not want women to wear, you know, ankle length garb. He does not care particularly about God. And I think that you might make it more about the surveillance state than it is in the show. And I actually haven't read the book, but in the show, certainly, like, it's more about people reporting on each other than it is, you know, like technology spying on you, which I think is a preoccupation that might creep its way in if you were writing this show today.
Although the central problem of this society is fertility. And so you have to come up with a language that is somehow obsessed with fertility. And so I think biblical language, I mean, the actual idea of handmaids does come from the Bible. Mm-hmm. So having your handmaids deliver a baby when you yourself are what they used to call barren is a biblical idea. So it's almost as if the theological language is a sort of a convenient architecture for them to solve the main problem of their society, which is lack of children. Like, that's a critical thing to know, is that there are no children born in the society because there's been some chemical problems.
And also, of course, the, you know, one of the main pieces of evidence for the way that women are attempted to be controlled in contemporary America is around fertility and reproductive rights. So I don't think it's that far afield from, yeah, our president is not a religious man, but that doesn't mean that there, despite his ascendancy, there are continuing efforts to restrict women's lives in that way.
Although I think the cultural relevance comes more from, so when I see Handmaid's Tale, I think about Trump calling Kim Jong-un or, you know, or like calling the dictator of the Philippines. It's a way in which he flirts with a kind of dictatorial, mm-hmm, patriarchal, mm-hmm, society, mm-hmm, the way in which that it seems like we could sort of easily join that community of nations in this world. You know, the sort of casual flirtation he has with that kind of, you know, very kind of strong rule that feels more relevant to me, because the feminism in the book and I feel this in the show. I felt the book's a little different, but a lot different. But the feminism in the show is complicated, as we saw in the rollout of the movie. Did you guys read about what happened in the press conference when they were asked about it? Like whether they were feminist, and Elizabeth Moss gave that interesting answer. Did you guys read that?
Yeah, she said that she believes it to be a humanist tale rather than just a feminist tale, right? And I wonder why she did that. I guess to have it appeal to the.
You mean it felt evasive? Just to set it up, you're saying it felt like she was avoiding saying it's feminist.
Yeah, I think it's. You have to be very deliberately obstinate to not read this as a feminist, right, like allegory. It's pretty, I don't want to call it on the nose because I think it's really brilliant, but mm-hmm, but it is not subtle in its feminism. And I guess maybe she, like, I don't know, wants to appeal to the widest possible audience, whether that means, you know, men or people in the red states or whatever, however she's thinking about that. But like, I don't know. if you like spend a lot of time thinking about this, and also the distinction between feminism and humanism is something that I would have some problems with. But yeah, that I think was particularly strange. And also, just as a sidebar, in Elizabeth Moss, she doesn't like to publicize this a lot, but she is a Scientologist, and I kept thinking about that as you're watching like the weird cult like things happening. That seemed like an interesting tension in the choices that she has made in her personal life and in the choice to do this movie, which is, you know, I'm not saying that Scientology is a reproductive cult. Please don't sue me, Scientology lawyers, because I know you're very busy. But that was interesting to me.
Yeah, there are some overlaps, like the resistance to gayness, the resistance to medication of certain kinds. Like, there are some ways in which I thought the same thing, like, wow, this must be a tiny bit familiar to her. but I actually think the feminism thing is more complicated. Initially, I thought exactly what you thought, Noreen. Oh, this is just ridiculous, because there are moments in the show and sort of themes of this dystopia, which is a word she doesn't like, by the way. She likes speculative fiction. She doesn't like science fiction. There are moments which are so obviously resonant with things that we still talk about, like that amazing slut-shaming moment, you know, where one of the handmaids is sitting in the middle of the room and she's telling the story of essentially, I think, her rape. It's not, the details aren't entirely clear. And then everybody in the room is supposed to point at her and say, whose fault is it? Your fault. You know, it's like a parody of terrible slut shaming. And the whole air of the thing is that, you know, women are the handmaids are shunned and revered at the same time. Like, their sexuality is their power and their source of shame. Like, so much of it is so resonant with problems that we still have and live with.
And they are, like, basically enslaved by their reproductive ability, but also themselves, like, kind of love the idea of having a baby. That to me was a really interesting thing that they dealt with, like just the bonding. One of the characters has a baby through this rape situation, and she really loves the baby. And they're even, this might not turn out to be true later on, but even the Elizabeth Moss character seems to kind of like want to be pregnant and just not for the survival things. You know, she's lost a daughter. Just the connection between women's fertility and like how they just the psychic energy around women's fertility, I think, is fascinating in this.
But I feel like even that, there's ways in which Margaret Atwood is pushing back against feminism and what she perceives to be 70s feminism specifically. There's a character in the book, which isn't in the movie, which is June's mother. And in the movie, June's mother is sort of like a slightly kind of a bitter 70s feminist who rejects a lot about femininity. She rejects men and marriage and beauty and, you know, all she's like a kind of boiled down stereotype of 70s feminism. And in the Rebecca Mead profile in The New Yorker, Margaret Atwood told her that she has an aversion to the term feminist because she thought it was used in the 1970s by women who rejected women like her because she liked wearing lipstick and being feminine. And I feel like there you can't miss the elements of that in The Handmaid's Tale. You know, the way women are pulled in some sense by their nature, you know, nature in parentheses, even as the show is telling you that that's horrifying. Or the way in which so many women turn on each other. You know, like, female friendship is really strong in the TV series, but so is female hatred and rejection. Like, those two things are equally powerful, I thought, in the TV series.
Yeah, Nora Kaplan-Bricker had a really good piece in Slate about, you know, analyzing the, you know, those tensions that you were just talking about, Hannah. And it is clear that Atwood is very uncomfortable and has, I think, what Nora called skepticism of movements and ideologies and the kind of the forces that flatten individuality. I mean, in a sense, it's you know, that is what totalitarianism does, of course. It takes away your individuality. Instead of, you know, having an actual conversation outside of your own head, you're restricted to saying things like under his eye. And so I think that, you know, although Margaret Atwood is very active on Twitter, I imagine that she would be one of those people who, you know, sees a great deal of who's made anxious and uncomfortable by the kind of what's often referred to as like social justice, you know, warriors on Twitter, and that kind of policing of thought. So I can see that. At the same time, this, as Noreen said, for all of that, this book and this show is so clearly feminist that it is the kind of show that provides cover so that you can say, no, it's not about women. Like, you can say it's not about anything because it's so obvious what it is about, that it's kind of undeniable. I have to say, too, that, you know, just as when the book came out 30 plus years ago, not everything, of course, but there are certain things that seem to be so extreme in this book that are still the law in Saudi Arabia, you know, where women can't have money of their own and can't move without permission of a man and can't drive. And, you know, the United States is not Saudi Arabia, but nor is this unheard of, something that you might only see in a book.
Yeah. I got to say, I think there are so many things that this TV series did well, like so many things. I mean, mm-hmm. in Margaret Atwood's book, it's essentially she's writing about it after the fact. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of distance to it. You know, it's like her kind of, I guess, memoir or diary mm-hmm. in a sense. And it's so much more immediate in the TV series. Like it's so much more in your face because you don't have, you just don't have that distance. Also the way they modernized it, like just the computers, the way people talk, like the friendships between the girls, like it's just so familiar yeah. and well done. And then finally, like the particular relationships are much more drawn out in the TV series. Her, like just her desires, like her relationship with the commander, her relationship with the wife, I just think are so good. Do you guys agree with that? I'm really not that critical about it. I just yeah. thought it was really, really, really well done.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the pacing is yeah. good. Yeah. Like they're good at making a creepy thing happen just in time to reel you in.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack is used to good effect. I think it's a well done show.
Yeah.
Also, don't you think Elizabeth Moss is especially good? Because there's something about her face which can seem simultaneously plain and suppressed, mm-hmm. Really stressed out, absolutely beautiful, just kind of repulsive almost, you know, her face is so changeable that way.
Yes.
That she really can embody the kind of different, pretty extreme modes that a woman is put into in that society so well.
Yeah, I thought it was really brilliant casting. And Alexis Bledel is good too. She's in it. But it really, like, in the contrast between the two, you really feel a little bad because Elizabeth Moss's face is such an instrument for her. And Alexis Bledel is like trying very hard to do the same, but it's not, you know, it's like big eyes filling with tears.
And
I just watched the end of episode 3 where her big eyes filled with tears for a very good reason.
Exactly. And, oh my God, that is amazing. And actually everybody, the acting really is superb and the casting too, like Yvonne Strahorski, who plays Serena Joy, who has typically had, you know, like the pretty girl roles, like she was in Chuck. And she's fantastic. And Samira Wiley, who's playing a role that's not all that dissimilar in many ways to her Orange is the New Black role, so far in the first 3 episodes anyway, is also great. Like, there's just really good acting in it.
Yeah, and Samira Wiley, she's great. And that friendship is actually mm-hmm. really, I think, creates such a beautiful tension in the series that isn't really in the book. There's not that much sisterhood, really, mm-hmm. the way there is in the TV series. There's you really feel their friendship in the past. Like you really feel what she's lost, the friendship between the Elizabeth Moss character and Samira Wiley, because they're best friends. Okay, well, I would say we are all recommending that you watch Handmaid's Tale and share with us what you think, right? We're definitely
Absolutely.
Recommending that.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, Ivanka time. I don't know why I said it like that, but it is Ivanka time. All right, she's out with a new book, Women Who Work, about the realities of being a working mother. She is taking a seat on an international stage next to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. I rely on June for these pronunciations. And she's talking unironically about her father's advocacy of women. It feels like she's going to have many, many, many moments over the next 4 years. This is a big one. My question to you guys is, who do you think she's trying to be? Like, what is she positioning herself as? Is this like a Sheryl Sandberg move or a Gwyneth Paltrow move? Like, what is the brand? What is the brand that she is after with her book, with the way she presents herself as her father's, I don't know what, like confidant, I guess, is the most we'll say.
Well, now. I think when she originally set out to write this book, it was I think, a weird mashup of Gwyneth and Cheryl. It was like her goals were Gwyneth. She wanted to sell stuff, but she decided that the way to position herself in the market with the women she wanted to sell to was to borrow a little of the Sheryl Sandberg thing, but to take the Sheryl Sandberg thing and like give it a long blonde haircut. Like her thing seems to have been, when she made the choice to rebrand as feminist in 2013,
As hashtag women who work.
As hashtag women who work. Her whole thing seems to have been that there was this bad stereotype of women who work as androgynous and a little frazzled, which I guess frazzled is still in the culture, but androgynous is like a... That is, a relic of the era when Donald Trump was in the tabloids with his first wife. That's an old stereotype. So she seems to want to borrow the very modern language of feminism to sell her brand. Now, I think the wrinkle in it all is like, how do you then work in stateswoman into that? How does that affect your brand? I don't think she's fully figured that out yet.
And yet, just the fact that she has this role as like a senior White House advisor, the only reason that she has that role, the only way that she's even remotely qualified for that role, is because she's a Donald Trump whisperer, perhaps the Donald Trump whisperer, mm-hmm. Which may be created. There's a lot of kind of, stage management about how the message goes out, as there always is, I suppose. But it is clear that he is particularly open to advice from members of the family. That is how he's always been. He's kind of closed off from everyone but his family members. So I think that's her brand, that her brand is simultaneously as Donald Trump's closest family member, but also she's like the acceptable face of the Trump administration. There's an attempt to appeal to women in a way that it's absolutely impossible for her father to.
Well, and not just to appeal to women, but just to appeal to liberal women, I think is something she's very interested in continuing to do now. She has very much positioned herself as a moderating force in the administration. A sort of hawkish moderating force. She seems to have been a big influence behind the Trump administration's decision about Syria. I have to say that it's working on me a little bit. Her sort of press tour saying that she is a moderating force. The Ivanka, Jared, Gary Cohn wing of the White House seems to be pushing out the Steve Bannon, Steve Miller wing these days. And, personally, as the lesser of two evils, I would rather have that, even if I am very cynical about all the ways that she sells herself and am concerned about her lack of experience and, the many, many conflicts of interest. I still would rather have the person who has the president's ear have views that are sort of closer to my own than Steve Bannon. But am I just getting snowed? Am I like another client for Ivanka?
Oh, my God. As I'm listening to you guys talk, I'm like, I'm following bits and pieces, like everything you're saying is correct. And yet I'm thinking, how the hell does this brand hold together? Like it just doesn't. No, she's like, is it a brand or is she actually trying to do something for the country? And like, I can't even place her in a certain decade. Like what decade is she, And how do you simultaneously become the person who, like, she wanted to appeal to liberal women, but then she is now so prominently Trump's daughter and associated with the Trump administration and saying things like, do you think she planted then that anecdote at the top of the New York Times magazine
about her
piece
crying?
That was like, about how she was super stressed out and crying when he had that Hollywood Access video, like that really freaked her out. Now that you're talking, Noreen, I'm like, oh my God, this whole thing is a brand. Like, should we trust her? Like, every step seems like a branding move. So now I no longer know what to think. Like, I don't believe that anecdote anymore after what you guys just said. The anecdote was basically that she cried and really yelled at him and she wanted him to make like a vociferous apology. But it's not believable. Like, she knows who her father is.
Right.
Or maybe you never know who your father is. Yeah, can I just read you guys a thing from the book?
I'm ready to be inspired, Hannah.
I don't know why this particular thing made me laugh and it made me think, like, what audience? I began to wonder whether I'd been doing women who work a disservice by not owning the reality that because I've got an infant, I'm in my bathroom at 7 a.m. and there's pureed avocado all over me.
Why did that one make you laugh more? Because it was so upscale?
It's just like, you know, I want to be really honest about the fact that sometimes I'm digging in the garden with the kids in our backyard, my hair in a messy ponytail.
Yeah.
It's like, what? Is that as real as it gets up over there? Exactly. Like a pureed avocado
exactly.
and digging in the garden? I'm like, oh, shit. No way. That is really some, that is dirty. Ew.
Your hair like, is in a messy ponytail?
Messy
what?
Ponytail?
Well, she is incredibly self-congratulatory
yeah.
in this whole thing. I mean, that was what's really stunning to me. Her brand seems to be Ivanka is great, and I agree with that. Like that, just
yeah.
her. It's incredibly self-promotional, and I'm in favor of women being confident and all that. But that, I mean, the focus on her image, it was just, the whole thing was kind of bizarre. Wait, I'm trying to find my favorite part. Okay, so she's talking about the high capacity time of the campaign, which is like a weird business speak way to talk about like high capacity time. And she says, I went into survival mode. I worked and I was with my family. I didn't do much else. Honestly, I wasn't treating myself to a massage or making much time for self-care. Which that line, like, she should have maybe chosen a different example than a massage, which just has certain, like, the connotations are just, like, utter privilege. And then to use, I mean, we talked about self-care on this segment before, and I think, you know, maybe didn't do a good job of talking about the you know, Audre Lorde roots of the phrase. But, like, to hear it coming from Ivanka Trump's, you know, mouth in the form of her book, talking about how she didn't give enough massages to herself during the campaign, really like just killed that phrase for me even more than it already seemed dead as a, like, you know, rich women pampering themselves excuse. I'm not saying that a campaign isn't hard, but she should have, someone should have stopped her from including that sentence in her book because it's already been quoted everywhere, and I think it'll be quoted everywhere else.
It's
but
weird.
She doesn't know, right? Like
yeah.
what life is, that's the only life she's had, like in her old book. What was it called?
The Trump Card.
Yeah. Okay. In the Trump Card, she has anecdotes like that where she's feeling really sorry for herself because she couldn't do something normal, like have a lemonade stand. Like there is a poor little rich girl. Like she just doesn't know the boundaries of the universe. Like how could she? You know?
Yeah.
Like
one of the things that people have pointed out is that a lot of the examples that she gives, for example, she talks about, you know, her toddler coming to the office on Wednesdays and having, you know, lunch with mom and other examples like that. And they've said, you know, the only way you can do this is when you have help. You know, the only way you can your kids can come by the office is if someone brings them and takes them back home. This is not something that normal working moms can incorporate into their work life. And, you know, this is definitely part of the Trump I don't even know what to call it, the Trump image, you know, like if you remember that the thing that one of the many sort of moments with Donald Trump on the campaign trail that really stuck with me was when he did that town hall, or the whole family did a town hall with Anderson Cooper. And all they could talk about, he was giving them opportunities to talk about like their memories of their dad, their memories of growing up, their family time memories. And it was all about work. And it was clearly very scripted. But, you know, it's a campaign situation. Of course it is. But all they could talk about was going to job sites, going to work sites, going. And it's like that's clearly part of this family's image of like we're super hardworking. You know, the fact that they also inherited millions of dollars that may have made their work considerably easier never gets mentioned, and why would it? But, you know, this whole work thing is so key to their self-image. And, yeah, they don't seem to realize that their particular version of work is only possible because they are incredibly rich and incredibly privileged. And, like, not just average rich and privileged, but super rich and privileged.
But is it good to have a woman like her, just to push back a little bit, is it good for people to see a woman who is working, who is being included in international conversations? Like, it's not so much his sons. You know, it's clear that his sons are around, but it seems to me that she's the trusted advisor. She's the one he wants by his side, and not in a kind of, you know, my daughter is pretty decorative way, but in a way that feels real to a lot of people. Like, is that a good thing for the nation to see?
Aren't we past that kind of symbol, the need for that kind of symbolism? I hope. I mean, she
Trump supporters.
Trump supporters. I guess maybe it's a good thing. But
just say she has no qualifications for that role. Like, there are many, many women who would be great senior advisors, great people doing the kind of foreign policy work that she's doing because they actually know something about it. I don't have any indication that she does.
Right. This is, I mean, it is in some ways fitting that she's writing a self-help book because the confidence with which she is approaching this situation is the ultimate testament to the power of you know, belief in oneself and like the sort of, you know, idea that these vacuous bromides can get you anywhere you want to go, including, you know, on stage with Christine Lagarde and Angela Merkel. Like, she is really like a product of that kind of thinking and is sort of spewing it back out into the culture. And I sort of wonder if this book for many women might puncture corporate feminism that's being peddled to them in a way that other things maybe haven't. Like, maybe the bloom will be off the rose a little bit if they see. Well, if, you know, like, it's just laid the privilege and the it just laid so bare with Ivanka, right? That she is co-opting feminism to, I don't even know that she calls it feminism, but she's co-opting the ideas of feminism to
promote her brand.
Promote her brand. And that it's nothing more than that. And I think it will, you know, Sheryl Sandberg is a very different person than Ivanka, but I think it will rub people wrong who were not rubbed wrong by Lean In.
Yeah. I also think the problem with Ivanka as a symbol of anything is that she's in a category of one, you know, like there aren't a lot of people like her. Just because Trump has her by his side doesn't mean that he thinks anything about women or that it means anything for women. You know, she happens to be his very intelligent, very hardworking, accomplished daughter, and he only trusts members of his own family fully. And so that's what that means. You know, it means that she's his daughter and it doesn't mean much else.
Right. Yeah, and the things that she says don't have any basis in his policies or in anything that they are, you know, moving toward. We've seen that over and over again, and so it's her words are particularly empty on top of it.
Well, I don't know if that's. I think she has his ear. I think that it's a real stutter step situation. He'll say one thing about NAFTA in the morning and a different one at night.
Yeah.
But I do think that she has his ear in a very real way. And whether we think she's informed enough to like have that power is another question. But I do think he listens.
I love that anecdote about how he does his worst tweets on Saturdays because those guys celebrate Shabbat because she's not around. So if that's true, then maybe Noreen is right. All right, well, let's move on. So this month, Tom Perez, who's the head of the Democratic National Committee, and Bernie Sanders, you know who Bernie Sanders is, were out on a unity tour speaking for Democratic candidates across the country. And they both suggested in different ways that the progressive tent, Democratic Party, was big enough to include people who are not pro-choice. And here's what Perez said. If you demand fealty on every single issue, then it's a challenge. The Democratic Party platform acknowledges that we're pro-choice, but there are communities like some in Kansas where people have a different position. I love that, like, parentheses, just like a few in Kansas where people have some little bit of different positions. So this led many progressives and also feminists to worry that women's rights are the first things to go after an election loss, that essentially there's a pattern. The Democrats lose. They're like, we have to reach out to the working class voters that we've lost. And so ditch the women's rights because it's, you know, low hanging fruit. How did the comments strike you guys? Like, we'll take the one that I just read. If you demand fealty on every single issue, what do you guys think about that?
Well, I think that, yeah, I think you could make a good argument that litmus tests are problematic. The problem is that Perez and Sanders, especially Sanders, did have some litmus tests. Bernie Sanders refused to endorse John Ossoff, the guy who was running in Georgia 6, the Democrat who made a run in a heavily, heavily Republican district in Georgia and almost won the seat. Now he's in a runoff.
With the woman
with a hideous woman, Karen Handel, who is both anti-Planned Parenthood and also anti-voting rights. And nevertheless, Bernie Sanders refused to endorse him because he doesn't say the right things about, like, labor protections and climate change, or actually, what was it? There's something very specific.
Income that, inequality.
Income inequality. Yeah. Thank you. So that Sanders was himself had a litmus test. It's just that it was only around economic issues and not what he likes to call social issues, which seems to suggest that social issues have no economic component, which is just nonsense. So in other words, I would say that those comments rubbed me the wrong way.
I mean, I was also struck by the fact that both sides had a litmus test, June. And I think, like, you can't allow the side that you identify with more to have a litmus test and not the other one, right? Like, it's not like Bernie Sanders campaigned against John Ossoff. He actually said, like, it's imperative that he wins. Mm-hmm. He just did not, you know, give his endorsement. He did not give his official, you know, John Ossoff is a progressive.
But he did give his imprimatur to Heath Mellow, which is a fantastic name, who is running for mayor of what?
Omaha,
Nebraska, who is not only himself anti-choice, but has, when he was in the state Senate, pushed legislation that tried to restrict access to reproductive rights. And that feels to me like a difference. Like, we can all have views. And clearly, many people do have religious differences with, for example, abortion. But we can still endorse those people, but not if they've pushed legislation that goes against, that restricts reproductive rights.
Well, I am interested in the way that 2009 legislation has been portrayed. So I've read two different things about this. So first of all, my understanding of Mellow is that he is sort of the classic religious Catholic politicians has that view on abortion, which is that he says that he is personally pro-life, but, you know, effectively the way that he as a Democrat will vote and govern is pro-choice, right? So he is drawing a distinction between his personal feelings about abortion and the way that he believes the American legal system should handle it. So I feel like we need a better way of referring to those people than just anti-choice. But I'm sure that I will get lots of letters about how that's not fair. But I do strongly think that we should take people seriously when they say that. I think Paul Begala said this, you know, you're out of power. Do you want to be having, you know, do you want to be pointing out heretics in your party, or do you want to be bringing in converts? And I right now am feeling like maybe converts is a smarter thing to be doing. But push back. Tell me all the ways I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, how do you bring in converts? I think this is a discussion that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have every single time. Kind of, how do we reach out without selling our soul? So it's, you know, it's a conversation that happens. I think the reason it pisses people off, because at the moment, you know, at the moment, sort of the last couple of months, the resistance to Trump has come from women. The women's marches, you do feel like the women's movement has fueled so much of what's become important in progressive of politics just now in the last couple months. And so it feels like a slap in the face to say, like, hey, we could choose a lot of different things that we're not going to make a big deal about. It could be reproductive rights. It could be gay marriage. It could be this. It could be that. So why pick reproductive rights when that seems to affect the most people? On the other hand, like, Paul Begala and in a sense, Bernie Sanders is right. Bernie Sanders talks about it strategically. He doesn't talk about it ideologically. He's like, look, we do have a problem right now. We are perceived as this party that is kind of, you know, single-mindedly focused on identity politics. Like, that's the image of the Democratic Party out there in the world. That's what's become culturally alien. So forget about its actual policies. That's just how sort of culturally the Democratic Party is perceived out there in the world. So that's a real discussion. And then how do you solve that problem? I actually think these guys solve that problem incorrectly. Like, there's a way to reframe abortion rights. I mean, Rebecca Traister says, oh, well, but abortion is about, in her piece about this in New York Magazine, it's about economic issues. But you know what? We don't talk about it like it's about economic issues. We never talk about it that way. There's been lots of policy people who have said, why don't you talk about, you can talk about abortion as a kind of family planning thing. Like, we in the Democratic Party believe that that families should be able to plan their life. Like, it, you could change the language around abortion and do absolutely nothing in policy. But it feels like just digging in your heels and saying, like, no, women's rights is important. This is important. It's like the way you're talking is just alienating people. Now, if you don't care, that's fine. But it is alienating people. So maybe think of language which addresses people's profound economic insecurity without betray. Like, you don't, like, throw the gays to the wolves. Throw the women to the wolves. Like, that's stupid, right? And a slap in the face, genuinely. But it's also not that smart just not to address the issue at all, which is, like, so how do we bring in converts, and what is culturally alien about the way we are being and speaking, and what did this last election teach us, and is there any way in which we can stay true to ourselves but kind of present ourselves in a way which is a little less in the bubble? All right. Well, those are our political words of wisdom for the show. Let's end with our recommendations. June, what do you have today?
So I have two. One is just complete self-horn tooting, which is the Americans podcast, which is a podcast that I produce and host. And it's a bit of a Carina Longworth situation for me.
And wait, what does that mean?
It's basically me and all the marvelous cast and crew and actors on The Americans. And it's a spoilery thing. Like, if you're not watching the show, it probably doesn't make a lot of sense because it's a full spoiler situation. You're supposed to have seen the show first. But this week's episode is one of my very favorite and includes an interview, which I can't really say who it's with because even that is a spoiler. But I really loved it. So if you're going to just listen to one episode, listen to this week's for 509. But also, I wanted to recommend a radio drama that I heard on Radio 4, which you can now hear very easily with the iPlayer on your phone. And I've always been aware that I know very little about Russian history. And this year, as we're coming into the 100th anniversary of the October Revolution, Radio 4 is doing, that is BBC Radio 4, is doing a series of plays about leaders of Russia. It's the overall series is called Tsar. And this week there was an episode about Catherine the Great, and it was so fantastic. And it was also, like, filthy. There were all these sex sounds throughout and terrible language. But it really helped me understand, like, the political forces that created Catherine the Great and what was going on in Russia at the time. So I really recommend it.
Excellent. And I don't watch The Americans, but everyone who I know who does, several of whom are in my family, loves your podcast.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to recommend a fellow lady science fiction writer. When I was reading Margaret Atwood's interviews and she was resisting the label science fiction and world building for speculative fiction, seeming to indicate that she's more interested in the past, kind of the lessons of the past, I was put in the mind of Ursula Le Guin. I went on a huge Ursula Le Guin binge about this last summer, actually. And Lathe of Heaven is a book that I like, but I love her sort of intensity and kind of psychological specificity. So if you are reading or watching The Handmaid's Tale and you need another fix, I would say you should go pick up some Ursula for yourself and satisfy it. Noreen, what do you have?
While I was on my vacation, began a delightful beach read, which I'm still finishing up, The Diana Chronicles by Tina Brown. Have either of you guys read this?
No.
So it's about Princess Diana. I'm not particularly, like, a royal watcher, you know? Like, I'm a reader of the Daily Mail, so I will click on a story about Princess Charlotte or whatever from time to time, but I've never really gone deep into that world. And it's just really fun. And Tina Brown is good company. She's like imperiously catty and sourced up and a little tabloidy, and somehow manages to go into all the family tree stuff without it being boring. And she's just, like, sharply evaluative in a way that you want a biographer to be. And it like goes a lot into Prince Charles and, you know, Camilla Parker Bowles. It's a great read if you're looking for something at the beach or just the summer or something fun. Cannot recommend it highly enough. The Diana Chronicles.
I have to reveal
that
something.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I have to reveal something about myself, which is that I hate the royal family. I'm a complete Republican.
I already knew that.
However, this week that picture of Princess Charlotte went around. Aww. That she has the cute little cardigan with the sheep, and I immediately was able to send around on Slack a picture of a similar sweater that Princess Di wore that my grandma made me a knockoff copy of. And so obviously, for all that I say that I hate them, I seem to know a lot about their wardrobe and what sweaters they wore in 1985, you know?
That's really funny.
I wonder if the royals were the first hate watching. Like, is that, you know, for kids like you, right, like before hate watching became just exclusively a TV thing. That's it's like awesome. You're fascinated, but you loathe them.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our show. Thanks to our producer, Vera Lynn Williams, the executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lickteig, and Andy Bowers, the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, our intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. For more information about the show and to see our recommendations, you can go to slate.com/XX. Facebook is facebook.com/XXGabFest. Thank you to all of you for many of your excellent comments and suggestions on the Facebook page. You can email us, which many of you do, at XXGabFest@slate.com, or subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave comments and reviews so more people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I am Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.